Today is Transfiguration Sunday in the life of the church, that Sunday every year that comes right before Lent begins. And today I'll be reading the Transfiguration story as found in Mark's Gospel, chapter 9, verses 2 through verse 9. I'll be reading from the New Revised Standard Version. 6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain apart by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his clothes became dazzling white, such as no one on earth could bleach them. And there appeared to them Elijah with Moses, who were talking with Jesus. And then Peter said to Jesus, "Rabbi, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what to say, for they were terrified. And then a cloud overshadowed them, and from the cloud there came a voice, "This is my Son, the Beloved. Listen to him." Suddenly they looked around, and they saw no one with them anymore, but only Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, he ordered them to tell no one about what they had seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. Here ends the reading. May God grant us wisdom and courage for interpretation. Over the tenure of my 24 plus years in ministry, I have had the good pleasure of officiating dozens, and I haven't counted, probably hundreds of weddings along the way. And when I know the couple in a personal way, I will, as long as my schedule allows, try to stick around for at least a good portion of the reception. I would venture a guess to say that at least somewhere around at half of these weddings, at some point, either before or after the service, or maybe an exception during the service, or most certainly afterwards at the reception, I have heard Al Green's 1971 hit single played, "Let's Stay Together." Now, what's interesting about this song is that ever since its release, it has made many appearances in movies and TV shows. It has been covered by other artists along the way, such as Tina Turner and more recently Maroon 5. And every time the song gets played, its sales of the original just spike again. Is it the good beat? Perhaps. Is it the love-based theme that just makes this song feel so great? Perhaps. For me, it's the raspy, soulful falsetto that Al Green uses at the beginning of the chorus, you know the one, that never ceases to make my nostalgia level rise and remember so many of the different times and places I've been along the way, the weddings I've officiated along the journey. Ironically, as I did a little background research on the song, Mr. Green fought his agents over ever releasing this song to the public at first. His main reason? He thought his falsetto was too thin and that this song didn't have what it took to be a hit. Well, I bet Al Green was really glad he listened to his agents now, don't you? Declaring one's love and one's desire to stay together, as the song puts it, with someone they deeply love, well, that's a good feeling, especially when you combine it with a laid-back beat and a groove and some really soulful singing. Wouldn't hurt to have some warmer weather. It's easy to see why this song makes so many folks feel nostalgic every time they hear it. I know I do. And the truth is, who doesn't like to wallow every so often in a bit of nostalgia? But nostalgia, you see, is a double-edged sword. On the one side of the blade, there's the positive reflection on our life's greatest memories and moments and the things that we cherish the most. And who doesn't need some encouraging, positive things to celebrate and claim as precious memories along the way, right? But on the other side of that double-edged sword, the second blade about on the other side of nostalgia is the cutting truth that nostalgia, when wallowed in for too long, can become a sort of cherry-picking of our past at the expense of our present and future. In other words, if we spend too much time reflecting backwards, We tend to selectively choose the good stuff, leave out most of the bad stuff, and in so doing develop a distorted memory of the past. Not us, right? We're way too sophisticated and free-thinking to fall into that sort of tomfoolery, surely. Well, this sort of tomfoolery is exactly what was happening in our scripture lesson, actually, on Peter's part in Mark's gospel lesson for today. And once again, if you're a biblical literalist, chances are you just might miss the most obvious and spiritually impactful points of this highly symbolic, larger-than-life story. The author of Mark's gospel does very little accidentally. And in this story on the mountain, there is an intentional parallel that he's drawing to Mount Sinai for Jewish listeners to this story, the place and setting on which Moses, the one who gave the law and the importance that he brought to those who would have been the first audience of Mark's gospel, cannot be ignored. Nor can the presence of Elijah, the one who, no doubt, as legends say, didn't die a normal death, but whose special role as the fiery prophet of God in the nation of Israel was forever etched in history by his ascent straight from earth into the gates of heaven, having never died a, quote, normal death. Many literalists get a bit of a case of biblical attention deficit syndrome when reading this story and get so caught up in the ooh, shiny Jesus part of the story that they miss the blatant truth right under our very noses that the author is trying to make and would have been understood by the original audience, that there on this mountaintop experience, Jesus and these three disciples are sitting in the presence of the law and the prophets. That's why Moses and Elijah are placed here in this story. It's not just for who they were to the Hebrews, but for what they represent to the Hebrew listeners of this story. The law, the divine mandates carved on stone tablets handed down by God, were going to really revolutionize the way that the nation of Israel lived out their lives together. They thought at the time of the law, back in the time of Moses, ironically, that law and order would surely cure what had ailed them as a nation. That theme still sounds familiar today. When law and order would not work, the people of Israel had historically relied on these fiery folks known as prophets, and there were none they were more proud of than the prophet Elijah. Many think of prophets as people who foretell the future, but actually, within our tradition, prophets tell forth the truth more than foretelling the future. And when the law failed, they needed someone along the way who would just say it like it is. But prophets were always more popular after they were dead and gone. Because of their normally nasty temperament and thankless role of telling it like it really was to an audience who wasn't always so grateful to be reminded of reality of the situation they faced. Go ahead, if you wish, and make this story about the shiny clothes Jesus was wearing. There was definitely something going on. We're supposed to pay attention, but I suggest the most obvious lesson is from watching these disciples. Peter, God love him, kicks it into full-blown nostalgia mode in this vision when he recognizes Moses and Elijah are there alongside Jesus. You can say he got a bit carried away, and I'm sure if we were there, we would have heard him in his most soulful Al Green falsetto as he belted out, "Hey, Jesus, Moses, and Elijah, let's just stay together." But they suggested, you know, Peter suggested he build a little hut for each of them so that they could, you know, to use a few more song lyrics, turn back time, bring back that loving feeling, and stand by their man. Mark is making a very crucial point that is still so relevant today. By Jesus' reaction and his refusal to go along with Peter's nostalgic whims, Mark is showing ancient and present day disciples of Jesus that one cannot rely on what once worked in the past to guide you spiritually in the present. The past is to be built on, but not to be worshipped. And Mark is illustrating for Peter, for James, for John, and for that matter, for any of us who would read this story, as I believe it was intended to be read, that it matters little how one feels while on the mountaintop, that what matters the most is how straight one walks when they hit the valley floor, how closely one follows Jesus when Jesus comes down from the mountaintop and where the rubber hits the road, that if one truly desires to be a disciple of Jesus of Nazareth, one must follow the same path of Jesus of Nazareth into our neighborhoods and present lives today. While still celebrating the past, we refuse to stay there. For Jesus ever is walking in front of us in our present and future days. Nostalgia has always plagued Christian discipleship. Franciscan priest and Christian author Father Richard Rohr has said, "We worshiped Jesus instead of following him on his same path. We made Jesus into a mere religion instead of a journey toward union with God and everything else. And this shift made us into a religion of belonging and believing instead of a religion of transformation." Ouch. Here's the problem we still face that the Transfiguration brings to light for us. We have been called to transform the world with our feet on the ground by following Jesus in our daily lives. But many of us choose to stay at the mountaintop, so, you know, figuratively speaking, of religious ideals. And what we're doing is hanging out with the law and the prophets instead of following Jesus. We go to church, we worship, we talk with our friends, and the truth is we seldom put into practice what we talk so much about in the friendly confines of our church buildings. A holy huddle that never returns to the line of scrimmage, so to speak, where the actual game of life takes place. The truth is, it's much more comfortable to talk about Christian living than it is to actually live it. In regards to wanting to hang out with our own versions of the law, maybe I need to explain myself a little bit more. When we tend to think of law-obsessed, misguided Christians, we usually think of the legalistic, you know, Puritan-esque driven groups of Christians who still like to rail against all kinds of evils, usually the stuff you shouldn't do, you know. You shouldn't drink or chew or go with girls who do, those kinds of folks. And there are certainly some things we should pay attention to, but the truth is, we've mostly chosen the kind of church that we're in today because we don't talk a lot about those kinds of things. So it's a little bit foreign to us, but every now and then when someone crosses the line and they say really hateful things, things that can't mask the underlying racism or homophobic attitudes, we catch it and we go, "Oh, well, I know I'm not that kind of a Christian." But there are other types of law-obsessed Christians on the other side of the fence as well. And you know what kind of occurs to me is I've noticed a lot of this rhetoric among some of my peers, among church members past and friends past that I know are Christians. I hear them say things or see things on social media, and it starts out like this: "Well, if you voted for blank, you can't be a Christian. If you do this or don't do that, there's no way you can be Christian." And while there are many behaviors that can be immoral and certainly unchristian, what both the left and the right sides of the Christian spectrum now have in common is an obsession with ultimatums. You can't be Christian if. Just fill in the blank. You can't be Christian if. I'll be honest. I've said it. I'm not proud of it. It's right there on the tip of most of our tongues, and this is called fundamentalism. And we fight it not just from the right, but from the middle and from the left. We fight extremism, and this type of approach becomes obsessed with the law. Another word for that is ultimatums. And so, on the right extreme is a side of Christianity obsessed with the misapplication of the scriptures as a law book instead of a book of love. And on the other, the left extreme, usually we like to obsess over exclusion. Ironically, by excluding those from the faith who do not include everyone the way we think they should be included. It was Jesus who came and, according to his own admission, fulfilled the law. And you know what he fulfilled the law to become? The law of the land today, according to the gospel as I understand it, is to be the law of love. Loving God by loving oneself and one's neighbor equally. Now, I realize you can read any number of Christian bloggers today to support how you might already be feeling about today's terribly divided, polarized political world and environment. But any blogger, Christian or otherwise, any prevailing attitude, any cultural trend that would encourage us to completely write off people that are different from us ceases to be Christian. Did you hear me? It is not for us to decide who is Christian or who is not Christian or who is devout or who is not devout. The law became love when Jesus stepped onto the scene. And when we follow Jesus down the mountain and then down the street into our own lives, we cannot follow him accurately and we cannot follow him intently if we're saying, well, you're not a Christian because you fill in the blank. This doesn't mean we don't call out Christians for behaving badly. We have to hold ourselves accountable. One day it might be me, and I need you to tell me. And one day it might be you, and I hope you'll love me if I tell you in a respectful way. But he never said to the law-obsessed, you're outside the faith. Now, he did call folks a brood of vipers and whitewash fences and a whole bunch of other nasty names, and he called them on their behavior. But he never said, you're outside the hope of redemption. He never said that. Not to a single person. And there's a huge difference between saying you're outside the faith and your efforts to follow the faith are misdirected. There's a huge difference. One calls for correction. The other is judgmental condemnation. One leaves room for love and the other is purely law. The truth is it's much easier than to draw a line in the sand and write off the person on the other side of the line than it is to step across the line and try to actually understand their side of whatever the issue that divides us is. It's also, by the way, just as a moment of pastoral privilege, a lot easier to fill a sermon with the content one's listeners would rather hear than to hold true to the law of love as I understand it and the person and work of Jesus Christ. And while I see a good many Christians still wanting to function under the law in one way or another today, I see even more who still struggle with choosing their prophets wisely. That's prophets with a PH. If you remember, I gave you earlier in this message a very important definition of prophets. Prophets in the history of the nation of Israel were not so much foretellers of the future, but forthtellers of the truth. They were centered on calling the nation of Israel to see things as God saw them. And this often required repentance. Often it required action. It often required prophets who would call for people to realign their behavior and their attitudes and to make matters even tougher. There were scores of fake prophets who would roll into town, pretend to have a word from the Lord, and cause all kinds of trouble. Now, the key to avoiding following false prophets was to be so consciously aware of the essentials of one's faith, so immersed in the authenticity of the central tenets of the gospel, that they could discern the difference between a legitimate prophet of God and a counterfeit. And many Christians today have tuned into counterfeit prophets. Some have chosen TV preachers like those who teach that health, wealth, and prosperity will follow you if you're truly a disciple of Jesus. But many Christians have also chosen partisan politics to be their prophets, Democrat and Republicans alike. Some of us, we tune into our favorite news networks and then we spout partisan political talking points because, you know, MSNBC or Fox News or ABC or whatever station tells us what we should be saying and thinking about, or because Barack Obama did something or Donald Trump did something or said something and they've become our prophets. But we need to do a better job as the people of God of choosing our prophets wisely. Prophets do not tell you what you want to hear, by the way. You can rest assured that if someone always tells you what you want to hear, they are no prophet. They're a parrot. There's a difference. For example, I don't need a Republican or Democrat to tell me that ignoring stories of women who are saying they're sexually abused is wrong. Because as a Christian, I can read the Gospels and I can see how Jesus interacted with women, never condemning, always empowering to serve and to live their lives to the fullest in a culture that was absolutely hyper-patriarchal. Even though on this one issue, I agree with some of the leaders that are out there playing political games, you know, trying to shape the way that our lives are lived out by making this all about partisan politics. My example is the person and the teachings and the gospel of Jesus of Nazareth. My Christian companions, I would encourage you, I implore you, do not give up your Christian discipleship in favor of partisan politics. Do not choose the law-driven life of ultimatums. Instead of throwing down the gauntlet, throw down your grudge. Resist evil. Fight against injustice and oppression with all your might. This is the gospel. But also recognize that in these polarized times in which we live, Christian discipleship means we must also hang on to love with all that we are. We must hang on to the truth that we have been called to a life of transformation. And this life of transformation means that we see every person, especially our enemies, as someone who is dearly loved by God. Now that is so much easier to say than it is to do. Despising one's behavior must not drive us to hate their personhood. For like ourselves, all persons are worthy of God's love. Love doesn't excuse hateful behavior, but love does leave room for redemption. Love holds on to the hope and possibility of transformation, even when it seems hopeless. Here's another way to say what I guess I'm trying to say. Never hate the hate you hate so much that you forget that love is what conquers hate. But let's not get nostalgic either up on the mountaintop here in this pretty place. Let's celebrate this life of justice and love as we walk this road together in the here and now. As someone put into a song once, lovin', whether times are good or bad or happy or sad, let's stay together as we follow Jesus on the valley floor and beyond. Amen.